Morning. Can you please call the roll?
Chair Treachock? Chair Treachock?
Yes.
Vice Chair Carter?
Okay.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Hayes?
Here.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
Advisory member roll call, Mr. Campbell?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a quorum. We'll move to agenda item number one, public comment. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
There appears to be none, Mr. Chairman.
Any public comment in Reno? None. We'll move to agenda item number two, minutes. Do I have a motion for approval of the minutes?
I just have one correct. There's a correction.
Okay. Well, we get the motion in a second, and then we'll
They use the word different, and they should have used the word difference. It was on page.
Excuse me, Chair Treachock. Can he hear me? Did you ask for public comment in Elko? I don't think you did.
Oh, I didn't know we were live
Are we
in Elko.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, do we have any public comment in Elko? I'm sorry.
No public comment in Elko.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry that we didn't go to that immediately. Now, agenda item number 2 minutes. Do we have a motion for approval of the minutes?
So moved.
We have a motion from Regent Carter. Do we have a second?
Sure.
Okay, we have a second from Regent Hayes. Any discussion? Regent DiCarlo.
There was a word different. It should have been difference. We got the first page. I'll have to show it to you later. But there, I read. Yeah, it's just a word different to difference. That's everything else looked good.
If we have this motion in a second, if we have a change because of a typo, do we need to have a separate motion?
I don't believe so. I think, and for the record, it's on page 2.
Okay. You saw it too?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Bottom paragraph. Yeah, it's a typographical error.
It's 4 sentences up. I know in that paragraph.
It can be administrative.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a motion in a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? We move now to agenda item number 3. And just as an intro into agenda items number 3, 4, and 5, there are 4 pools that this board or this committee and the board oversees. Number 1 is the endowment pool. That's where we have an outside advisor, the OCIO. Russell is the our advisor for one half of the endowment pool. We have Cambridge Associates is the advisor for the second endowment pool. We then have the legacy pool, which are investments that have been made over the years that are not managed by any paid manager. And then we have our operating pool. And this is the pool that contains the cash reserves for each of the 8 institutions. And we are the investment advisors for the operating pool. We as this committee and then the Board of Regents as a whole are the trustees and the advisors for that operating pool. So we'll move now to item number 3, investment pool performance, Russell Investments. Matt, are you on the line?
Uh-oh.
Okay, we'll go to agenda item number 4, endowment pool performance, Cambridge and Associates.
Sure. So I suggest starting in the Cambridge materials, item 4, on page 9 of 40, which gives a nice overview over various time periods. The good news is, since the last time we all met as a group, markets have experienced a very strong rebound. We have some numbers here on this page summarizing that rebound, and then what's not on the page but is a rough estimate is that the total endowment and the Cambridge pool are up about 0.5% for the month of March through yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's an estimate, could be subject to change. But looking here at the results through February 28th, I'll focus on the Cambridge managed pool, net of Cambridge's fees. The portfolio has returned 8.4% for the calendar year to date, the first 2 months, so a very strong rebound. Unfortunately, when we go back to the fiscal year to date, we're only up 1.1%, which reflects the fact that the results had been very weak in the fourth quarter of calendar year 2018. For both of those periods, though, we're showing outperformance in the Cambridge portfolio, 70 basis points about performance this year, 30 basis points for the fiscal year to date. Looking back over what is now almost 2 years since we began this dual OCIO structure, the Cambridge portfolio has returned 5.8% over that almost two-year period, which is lagging the policy benchmark by 50 basis points. I'd caution that a period of 23 months is a very short time period for what is a long-term portfolio strategy. And then looking down at the total endowment after we factor in Russell results as well as legacy assets, the total endowment over this time period has returned 6.2%, which is lagging the policy benchmark by 30 basis points. There are analytics, on pages 10 and 11 that dive a little deeper into the Cambridge performance for the trailing year as well as the fiscal year to date. And these are through January 31st. These were not updated, but many of these themes are the same, and you'll see the negative results through in most public equity asset classes on page on pages 10 and 11. But as I said, outperformance within the Cambridge pool. I know we only had 5 minutes on the agenda, so I'll pause and see if you'd like me to dive deeper.
I have some questions, but I'll defer first to members of the committee. Does anybody have any questions of Wendy? I take that silence as a no. So, Wendy, if we take a look at page 5.
Yes.
And we look at the annualized returns of 6.1%, and that's from 17 to 19. Is that correct?
Correct. That's the beginning of the Cambridge track record, the Cambridge and Russell track record.
And then net of fees, 331.17 of 5.8.
Yes.
And the difference between the two is what?
Is Cambridge's OCIO fee of 30 basis points.
Okay. And what are the, in dollars, what's the total fees, including all of your managers that manage the individual funds?
Yep. We presented that. That is detailed on page 6 of 40, the Board of Regents office numbering pagination. So... And this is always over a specific time period. So we looked at the fiscal year ended 6/30/18 to calculate the incentive fees, because performance incentive fees will always depend upon the performance of the underlying assets. So you'll see for that fiscal year period in the Cambridge portfolio, Cambridge's fee was 30 basis points or $342,000. The asset managers were $962,000 for their management fees, and $366,000 was a performance incentive fee. The top line, the 7.57%, is the return to the system net of all of these fees and expenses.
Okay, and that's for the managed assets. So that's
correct.
About $1.9 million. Why we pay incentive fees when I take a look at the second and third lines down, net of fees, we had a, for 17 through 19, we had a 5.8% return. Our benchmark is 6.2%, so we're down 5%. What's the criteria? What are the criteria for the incentive fees?
So each manager has a different incentive fee structure depending on their own specific results. This fiscal year return would be for July 1st, 2017 through June 30th, 2018. And so, for example, the, say, private investment managers, usually they get 20% of absolute performance, subject sometimes to a performance hurdle. So, and then there are some marketable managers that only get paid an incentive fee if they outperform their individual benchmark.
And who sets those performance?
The managers.
Do we negotiate that?
Cambridge does negotiate that, yes.
And are you satisfied with the fee structure?
We absolutely are. We push our managers hard.
Okay. And the and even though we have underperformed, you still think in your mind that this is reasonable, the $366,000 for those fees?
We do, because none of these incentive fees have been paid to managers who have underperformed. If any manager has underperformed, they do not earn the incentive fee.
And so then I move over to the legacy assets, mm-hmm. and you oversee those, but you don't manage those.
Correct.
And we have management fees and incentive fees for the legacy. Why would that be?
So it's each of the underlying fund managers earn a management fee.
And the funds have been invested in, our money has been invested in funds and in other assets. Is that correct?
It's all in funds. It's in private equity, venture capital, private real assets funds. So these tend to have higher fee structures, but you'll also note that they've delivered very, very high returns.
Okay.
So we are paying a commission, but on a net of fee basis, the results are extremely strong. We're very, very happy with those results.
Okay. Once you've signed the contract and agreed to fund, it's done.
Okay.
You can't go back and renegotiate.
So we're looking at about $2.5 million in fees that we pay on all of the our on the half that you manage on the endowment pool and on the legacy funds.
Yeah.
A little less than $2 million as I look at these numbers, or about $2 million if you combine Cambridge assets. So Cambridge managed assets, it's about $1.5 million, and then legacy, it looks like it's about $500,000.
Okay. Thank you. And then you report on page 5, not just the funds managed by Cambridge, but also by Russell.
Right. So as part of our agreement, the system had asked for a consolidated report. So Russell provides their performance data to us, and we consolidate it into a total endowments report.
And so consolidated, we're also underperforming.
That's right, for this two-year period. So you can see the relative performance for each slave. So Cambridge, we're underperforming by 50 basis points. Russell's underperformance is listed under their line. And then legacy assets have been outperforming their benchmark. So on an all-in basis for the total endowment, it's 30 basis points behind the policy benchmark.
And so for the all of the assets on an annualized trailing 10 years, we're underperforming. Here it says our target or benchmark is 10.2 and we're at 9.4.
Correct.
Is there something wrong with our benchmark, or is there something wrong with our performance?
I think there will always be periods of outperformance and underperformance. I would look to our OCIO structure to deliver outperformance over the longer term.
But 10 years is pretty long, isn't it?
Right, but we haven't had discretion over these assets for more than, it's been 23 months now.
When should we re-examine the benchmarks and the performance?
So I think we have a slide in here. It's on page, the evaluation period. It's on page 15 of 40. It's this blue table where we really set forth time periods, and these time periods are memorialized in the investment policy statement, of what relevant time periods to examine performance over different benchmarks. So the policy benchmark, it's memorialized in the investment policy statement as a rolling three-year periods, a simple 70-30 stock bond index is a full equity market cycle, which is often somewhere in the 5 to 10 year range, although frankly right now we're on the long side of that. We're a little over 10 years for a full equity market cycle. And then the long-term objective of meeting the payout and keeping pace with inflation, that's also meant to be an even longer benchmark.
So if I understand this, then after next year, your suggestion would be that we re-examine both the performance and the benchmarks?
I think it's fair.
Okay. Russell, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I'm less... concerned about realized performance because you can't change it. It's done. So my questions are always around, are there any things that you've decided to change as a firm in response to the underperformance? Is it changes in your investment process, how aggressive the portfolio is? Are there changes that you're making going forward to your own process in because you have the learnings that you've taken away from the last year or two?
So I don't think... short-term underperformance, we don't make massive changes to our strategy based on short-term underperformance. We understand the drivers of this. And in some cases, it's, for example, that we have a value bias in our portfolio, which over the long run, studies have shown outperforms. However, over short-term periods, especially the last couple of years, it's been painful for the portfolio. We still have conviction in that strategy for very long-term results. So I would say no, we haven't made any major shifts based on the fact that we've underperformed. In fact, we have a philosophical belief that's underpinned by results that if we adjust portfolio strategy based on what's in the rearview mirror, that's often a way to keep on underperforming because many of these performance patterns move in cycles. So we think we're sticking with our strategy.
On a related issue, I mean, an alternative is always to go passive, to just put it all in the stock market index and a bond market index and just ride with it. We would have done better if we'd done that.
Yeah.
What's sort of your argument for long-term continuing to pursue kind of an active strategy and continue to pursue private investments?
Yeah. So looking, over this past 10-year period, markets have been on really one direction, and simple portfolios outperform in up markets. Usually it's diversified portfolios that really prove their mettle during market sell-offs, and we saw that in the fourth quarter when there was significant downside protection. So we think for most of our clients that not the absolute returns over the long term are important, but that path of return is also important, and having a smoother path of return that might give up some upside in up markets, but typically protect in down markets, offers more stability to spending payouts, and that in itself, that smoother path can be a benefit to many of our clients who are relying on that payout.
Okay. I'd like to go back to the expense question because you were talking about what the fees are. Now, you in your report, you mentioned that there's $20 million committed to 17 private investments. So, in fact, our fees will go up, will continue to rise
That's
as a
right.
percentage of assets as we have more private investments, as they continue to unfurl their program, basically, in
that's
private investments.
That's
right. Something you should
be
aware of.
We're continuing to commit, and again, we focus on the return potential on a net of fees basis. And over time, private investments have delivered significant outperformance of public markets, and we are willing to pay higher fees to those managers when they're also delivering this outperformance on a net of fee basis.
I have a really obscure question to ask, and I'll try to make it as simple as it. You'll get it, but I'll try to make it as simple as I possibly can for people who aren't as familiar with this. Yeah, so you can get it. When they decide to make a private investment, they'll go to a large manager, say a BlackRock or a Blackstone or someone like that, and they'll say, we want to participate in a fund. And the fund will say, okay, we'll give you $100 million of capacity. You can put clients up to that $100 million threshold. Cambridge manages a lot of money. So at some point, they may have to make a decision about who gets access to that capacity and who doesn't. So my question to you is, what is your policy on allocating capacity? In other words, is we don't want to be the last man out, you know, the one that doesn't get the opportunity to participate in the best ones and maybe gets some of the crappy stuff.
It's a great question, and we are very, very diligent that we are prohibited from showing any favoritism between clients in giving in getting capacity to managers. And in fact, we, Cambridge, do not make these decisions whatsoever. During our process, and this is because of the fact that we don't have commingled funds. We give a manager a list of all of our clients for whom we think that this investment is a suitable investment.
Okay.
It's an indication of interest list. And then the managers themselves will either come back to Cambridge and say, we'll accept all of these clients, or in some cases, managers will cherry pick clients.
Really?
And it may depend upon the profile of the investor. Typically, I think a lot of managers like having nonprofit entities as their investors. So that's a notch in favor of the system. And sometimes it's just based on the dollar amount. There are certain managers who say, you know what, we don't have time to service 100 investors with $1 million commitments. We'd rather take your two big pension plans who each want $50 million, and then we only need to service two limited partners. Yeah. However, we also work with a number of pretty small managers, and I'm really happy to say that some of these small managers want these smaller dollar size because they don't want one limited partner to represent 50% of their fund.
Right.
So there have been cases where the system, because we're typically making commitments in the $1 to $2 million range to have a diversified portfolio, there are certain managers where they have picked the system and other similarly small clients of Cambridge and not accepted any larger clients.
Okay. I thought you should be aware of whatever their process is.
No, it's interesting, and I appreciate it.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Chair Tree Talk.
Regent Carter.
So I just want to clarify. So I'm looking at the incentive fees on page two. So in a year where we went negative, you get those incentive fees of that amount. If there was a positive increase, does that incentive rate go up, or is that a set incentive fee if they outperform, or how is that incentive fee determined?
So the incentive fee is determined by each individual manager's performance, but I do want to clarify that this period for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2018, the system's results were quite strong. It was a return of 7.6% in that period. So it wasn't negative over that period.
How many managers would have received an incentive fee?
In the Cambridge portfolio? So I hate to speculate. I would guess under five marketable managers. And we have some managers who, like one manager that we have where I love their fee structure, they have a 0% management fee and a 35% incentive fee over a benchmark.
Right.
So they only get paid if they are outperforming their benchmark. I love that symmetry, or asymmetry, I should say. On the private investment side, I'm not sure that any of the Cambridge funds are yet mature enough to be earning their incentive fees, because usually it's after they need longer, usually, to be showing positive results. I could check on that. I don't know off the top of my head. But the private investment managers are the ones that typically do earn the biggest incentive.
You know, the odds are, even if you have terrible performance for the overall fund, there's going to be one manager that actually does earn an incentive because they've done a good job.
Right.
So there will always be incentive fees.
Yeah. No, and I appreciated that explanation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any further questions? I would like to say that I appreciate this format, that we have the executive summary up front. That is crystal clear how much we're paying in fees. Everybody has all of the other 90 pages of data, and they can go through, and they will have analyzed that before they come into this meeting.
Great.
So I appreciate that very much. We'll now move to agenda item number three, Russell Investments. Matt, are you on the line?
I am. Apologies for kind of the fiasco on my side and getting connected in, but glad I'm on now. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you fine. So, why don't you had a different format? Why don't you take the committee to the important slides? I believe it starts on 24, and give us a summary of the performance. Yeah, and what I'd ask certainly. To Matt, the you have a separate a document that provides your fees, and I think it's only your fees. It's $185,000. I don't think, I'm assuming that doesn't include the incentive fees and the management fees for all of the managers investing that $100-odd million in the funds that you oversee.
Well, Tiba, why don't we tackle the fee issue or fee question first? I think that's all top of mind right now, given what Wendy just walked through. So let's, if you don't mind, tackle that fee slide to begin with. So the way our fees are structured, they're a little different than Cambridge, but ultimately, you know, obviously there's a price that you've got to pay for a couple different things here. One is a Russell management aspect as well as the sub-advisors. The way we price our vehicles, because they're commingled vehicles, we have all of the sub-advisors inside of our fee. So what you see here is the sum total of everything that Inchi pays, with the exception of the underlying sub-advisory fees on the hedge fund portfolio. So, for example, the core bond fund, you see 0.45%, 45 basis points. That's an annual charge for that fund. That covers all of Russell's cost and profit, as well as all of the underlying sub-advisors in that vehicle. Same thing is true of all the other line items. The only one where it's different and will be different is the hedge funds and private capital. The hedge funds, it attracts a 65 basis point fee for Russell, our portfolio management cost. There is an underlying sub-advisory fee, I would say approximately 1.5%. That's typical of the hedge fund community. They charge a flat fee, a management fee up front. Typically, that's been around 2%. In this particular portfolio, it's around 1.5%. There is an incentive fee that is also attached to that, and that's also sometimes known as a carry. And that can range anywhere between, say, 15 and maybe 20%. As I was looking at the performance, the outcomes of these, the investment managers we're using for you in the hedge fund portfolio, I'm not sure any of them have attracted an incentive fee over the last 12 months. Performance has been pretty rough, and so I don't think that maybe one has had an opportunity to earn that performance fee, but for the most part, that performance fee has not been a part of the cost. The way that those hedge fund, the flat fee, the management fee, and the performance fee is calculated, it is reflected in the portfolio value. It is not an explicit cost that is paid by Inchi outside of that, if you will. So it's a little bit different than perhaps how you may see it with the folks at Cambridge. But our sum total fees, I did some math as I heard you guys talking. I would estimate our fee, inclusive of the base hedge fund fee, to be circa $920,000 per annum. A little bit less on a live basis. I went back and totaled up the four invoices for 2018. They equaled about $680,000, plus if you add in about roughly $180,000 worth of hedge fund management fees, that works out to a little less than $700,000, about $680,000 in total fees paid by Inchi, outside of any incentive fees that might be accrued, but I don't think there were. That help?
It does help, but what we're driving at, and we've been requesting for the last few meetings, we would like to see all in a dollar number of all the fees that we pay as a system to you as the OCIO and to all of your managers that you oversee.
Right. And all other service providers as well. So if auditors are paid out of the assets of the fund, custodial fees, transaction fees, if somehow we could get a handle on all of those fees together, I think that'd be helpful.
I think that is incumbent upon us as trustees of public money.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that we understand all in how much this is costing the system.
I can happily revamp that exhibit. One thing that we won't probably be able to disclose is the underlying manager fees. That is a kind of a, I might call it a key difference between kind of how we operate in Cambridge. Like you heard Winnie speak about, we bring a lot of buying power to our clients by virtue of aggregating assets in these commingled vehicles, and it allows us to get some pretty great fees from the managers themselves. Typically, they don't want us to disclose that information outside of our four walls because of just it causes them headaches with their broader business efforts in the marketplace. So what I can do is I can show you this total fee for Russell plus the manager fees. I can break out the audit custodial fees separately and show those to you. They're relatively de minimis. Some of this is already incorporated in our fee, Russell's fee. We pay the custody ourselves. The audit support, some of the legal and some of the trading costs are borne by the funds, and I can break those out for you. And I can also show the hedge fund fees for each of the distinct hedge fund managers that you're using so that you have that all totaled up very nicely. Apologies for not providing as much detail on this first go-around, but I will true it up and make it more accurate for you.
Okay, and just to make sure that I understand before Regent DiCarlo has a question, what you're saying is you cannot give us the fee for any discrete manager, but you can give us a total of all of your manager's fees that you oversee.
Yeah. That's correct. And you see that on page, well, the additional page we supplied, you actually see that in the column on the far right, the fourth quarter invoice number. So those values are accurate, but they're not as discreetly shown as it sounds like you folks want, and I'm happy to kind of revise this.
I have a mean question for you, Matt, and my question is, in one of your, please, so in one of your funds, you say there's a 1.5% management fee charged to the fund, but because we pay you for the overall program, that fee is credited back. Is there some way that we can see that credit back? Is it given back every month, every day, every year? Like, how do we know that is actually credited back?
Actually, that's a good question, Russell. I guess I want to make sure I'm clear, and I may have misspoke there. The way the hedge funds are invested for you folks, we have actual discrete separate account hedge fund assignments for you. Okay. And inside of those valuations for each of those assets, there is a fee that is charged. I guess I would just need to dig into the accounting, and I should be able to isolate that for each of you. So it is paid out of the value of that assignment. It's not a fee that ever goes to Russell Investments. It's just simply as part of that assignment. So let me dig into that. And
just want to make sure we're not charged up. You know, I want to make sure we're not charged 1.5 plus your fee on top of it, you know. I don't think it is, but just if we could have some evidence of it.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you, Chair Trichuk. I'm just asking from a historical perspective. Before we went to the OCIO model, was this all done internally so we didn't have a Russell, we didn't have a Cambridge, so we knew exactly our fees? And so with this model now, we're just trying to identify what our fees are?
I would say yes and no.
Okay.
We were the investment. We were the Cambridge and the Russell. We had Cambridge who was assisting us. We were making those decisions. And at that time, our staff would be able to tell us this is how much we're paying for theoretically, how much we were paying for in fees for each of those. I thought it was important. Now that we've gone to the OCIO, everybody understands upfront exactly how much we're paying.
I totally agree with that. And by knowing what we are paying, we can compare to what we've paid and see if we're getting a return on investment, that kind of stuff.
So simply put, we always paid the managers. So asset managers for managing money. The only new thing is we now have OCIOs involved who are taking a lot of fiduciary responsibility or cooperating with us in terms of fiduciary responsibility and overseeing the portfolios on our behalf. So that's the big difference.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on fees? Seeing none, why don't we take a look at page 24? And Russell, in the future, I think it just like Cambridge did, if you can have your summary up front and then have all the backup information that everybody can review before they come to the meeting. And so if they have specific questions, committee members can go to the backup materials as support for their questions.
Okay. you want the performance summary up front. Okay, excellent. We can happily do that. Okay. Great. Well, let me dive in. I know that you've given me just maybe 5-10 minutes to talk through this, so I'll try and be relatively succinct. Did Wendy have an opportunity to talk about market performance, if that's worthwhile for the discussion?
I don't think it's relevant that everybody's seen the material.
Okay, excellent. Okay, very good. So I'm going to focus two ways. I'm going to talk about what's happened through February on a kind of a calendar year-to-day basis, and I'm also going to talk about on a trailing one-year basis. To me, those are the most two germane discussions. They are radically different in some ways in how their outcomes played out. So for calendar year 2019, after returns are up about 7.2% after fees, largely in line with the custom benchmark for our part of the pool. The underlying strategies we use also were largely in keeping with their benchmarks. The multi-asset growth strategy was the largest driver of absolute returns, up about a little over 10%, again, close to its benchmark. Not a bad outcome given kind of the rapid rise we've seen in risk strategies. The diversifying portfolio, which is another name for hedge funds, that posted about a little more than 1%. But I think in some ways, given that we use a fairly low beta exposure and a lot of non-directional strategies, that's not a bad outcome. I would like to see it more, and I'm going to talk about hedge funds in a few minutes a bit more. The fixed income portfolio is comprised of two parts. We used a core bond portfolio, something that follows the Barclays aggregate portfolio, and then we also use what we call an absolute return fixed income product. The core bond portfolio did all right in the period. It was up about, let's call it 1.2%, slightly ahead of its bogey, about 20 basis points ahead of its benchmark. So we added a little bit of relative value. There's been a bit of a resurgence in corporate credit. We like corporate credit. We typically are overweight that space. A lot of the success and failure of that is dependent upon corporate credit spreads. We saw those actually tighten so far in 2019, so our exposure to that part of the asset class was rewarded. The absolute return fixed income product, again, this is meant to be kind of a cash bogey. It was up about 2.4% for the year-to-date. You don't see it in your reports. So I'm looking at a more granular number here right now, but the two of those together had a decent level of kind of outcome. So broadly speaking, the absolute returns have been pretty good. What you're not going to see on your report is you see a zeros in there for the private real estate assets. Those are only valued on a quarterly basis. So given we're kind of reporting on an off-cycle basis, I don't have a number for you there. But if I had to provide a guess, a reasonable estimate of what that number is, I would expect it to be about 1.2% absolute for calendar year 2019 for the first 2 months. About half and half of that is between income and capital appreciation. That's been pretty typical for the private real estate asset class. So draw under the quarter-to-date numbers, good start to 2019. It would be nice to have been able to deliver a little bit of excess return, but we kind of hung in there after fees. Not a bad outcome. Let's talk about trailing one-year numbers. Those results are much more flat. They're only up about 50 basis points on a trailing 12-month basis through the end of Feb. Given the pretty tumultuous market environment we've had, I think that's not a bad outcome, but I am a little bit disappointed by the relative results we've delivered. We're about 1.5% behind the benchmark that we've assigned ourselves. It's meant to be a reasonable bogey, but there's a key element of it that has been pretty tough. So let me talk through the drivers of that as we go through it.
Before we do that, let's make sure that everybody is talking about the same numbers. And if I look on page 24 of 90, at the top of that, it says total assets, and you're looking at 1 year trailing. The return was 0.28, the daily benchmark is 2.43, and the strategic allocation benchmark is 2.74. Am I reading those numbers correctly?
That is right.
Fiscal. He's looking at the next column over.
Fiscal year-to-date, I think, is what you're looking for.
But you said one-year trailing. I want to make sure I understand what you're talking about. Are you talking about the last 12 months, or are you talking about fiscal year-to-date?
Last 12 months. So the one-year column starts with 0.28% net of fee return. than the dynamic benchmark, the strategic allocation benchmark of 2.74%.
Okay. So we're underperforming 2.5%.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
So and if we go out, while we're talking about these numbers, we go out since inception. What's the date of inception?
We're using a start date of January 1st of 2017. Okay. That is when the money came over to us. We strike that date a little differently than I think how we showed in the consolidated report with Cambridge, where we're striking a 3/31 start date. But on this particular report, we're using 1/1/2017.
So the two-year look back, it's about 1.1% below the benchmark.
That's right.
Okay. Okay. Sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
No. That's great. Good points. All right. So we have four major components in the portfolio. We have the multi-asset growth strategy. That's mainly all of your equities and big return-seeking assets that are on a listed basis. We have diversifiers. We have the real assets, which is private real estate and then fixed income. So in turn, the multi-asset growth strategy, we've positioned this thing fairly defensively for the better part of 12 or 18 months now, where we've taken less equity risk. We've had a pretty meaningful value bias over the last year. We have been kind of the opinion we're going to see rougher market performance. And we saw that happen in fourth quarter, but we thought it might happen earlier in the year. So what's gone on is we've been positioned defensively in a period where the equity markets have actually been pretty substantially rewarded, at least for the first part of 2019. And so that underweight to equities and risk in general wasn't actually rewarded in this period. Fourth quarter, we got paid. Fourth quarter of 2018, we actually outperformed by about 1%. But over the last 12 months, we've been undergeared to risk, and so we lagged the benchmark. We're resetting that equity risk a little bit in the portfolio currently. We've added more back to equity risk, primarily because we see accommodative monetary policy is actually now back on the table. If you saw what was happening last year, the Federal Reserve was very hawkish. They were planning on raising rates pretty substantially. In fact, they were planning on hiking four times in 2019 is what the best guess was. And then at the end of the year and the very beginning of this, Chairman Powell started talking about kind of taking a pause. And actually the language now is that they may be on a pause for the better part of this year with no rate hikes. That changes people's viewpoint, and so we're trying to get the portfolio back in line with what appears to be potentially a more rewarding next, I don't know, let's call it 6 to 9 months, where the markets actually may be favorable again. Fourth quarter was definitely, I think, a reminder of how volatile things are right now, but we're persuaded that the market might be doing okay for the period, so we're actually adding some risk back to the portfolio. But over the last 12 months, our more defensive posture was not rewarded on a relative basis. I'm going to talk about real assets and fixed income first and leave the diversifiers to the last. Real assets is private real estate portfolio. As you've seen, it, you know, it generated about 7.1% on a trailing one-year basis. That is behind its benchmark of 8.2. The reason partially for that is that we run a fairly conservative core real estate portfolio. We tend to use managers that are under-leveraged, and leverage matters in this space because private real estate, they have the opportunity to borrow against and buy these properties. It effectively creates a form of leverage in there, and it accelerates the amount of return. If you buy the property with debt that is not paying as much as what you expect to earn on the lease, that's a good outcome. And so some managers are more aggressive in using that, especially among the broader peer group. Our portfolio management team prefers to use investment strategies that are a little bit less leveraged, and so we have not done as well as the peer group over this window of time. But 7.1% is a nice solid return. I think it's the part of the, one of the defensive parts of the portfolio. It's a little bit less liquid. It definitely, I think, has potential to continue to deliver very solid results, but over this window of time, it's slightly behind its benchmark. The fixed income portfolio, again, I mentioned this earlier, this is comprised of two components, the absolute return fixed income product and the core bond portfolio. Those were about 2.6% absolute versus their benchmark of 2.9. This is, again, kind of the main risk diversifier in your portfolio, meant to have low volatility. The returns it's generated over the last 12 months, I think, are in keeping with what I would expect particularly the big after the big sell-off we saw in the fourth quarter. I'm not displeased with this outcome. I think it's actually a fine result. Would be nice to have outperformed by a little bit, but as I said earlier, one of the things that we believe long-term is that holding an overweight to corporate credit will be additive, and that has proven to be very true for our bond funds over a long window of time. But over the last 2 years, corporate credit has had kind of some evolution in how people have perceived it, and so we saw that credit risk kind of detract a little bit in the fourth quarter, and that is kind of set the tone for this one-year number. Okay. With that, I'm going to kind of look at the big elephant in the room here, which is the diversifiers. These are the hedge fund portfolio. And I would say I'm not real happy with what we've delivered here. We're down a little over 6% for the trailing 12 months. That really stands out because the bogey we're using is one of the most aggressive benchmarks we could possibly choose. We've chosen a cash plus 4% return. That's up over 6% for the trailing 12 months. If I look at a hedge fund peer group, they're actually down about, call it 4% over the last 12 months. So we've lagged the peers, but we're way behind this bogey that we've set for ourselves. And as I was thinking about it this morning, this benchmark was chosen purposefully. I assigned it because I think it's a reasonable expectation, but I have to say that it's a reasonable expectation over a full market cycle. I would love to be able to outperform every quarter, every year, but this has been a window of time where using an absolute return benchmark and against a peer group or a set of managers that take risk, pretty substantial risk at that, in different parts of the world, that hasn't paid off. The hedge fund managers that have kind of damaged the results of, recently that have really kind of been the source of this underperformance tend to be focused in distressed credit and emerging market debt. Both of those areas of the market have very attractive yields. Our hedge fund managers think they are long-term winners, but because the market has really fled to quality in recent quarters, those bets have not paid off. They were really kind of negatively rewarded. We also, kind of similarly to what we're doing in the multi-asset growth strategy, we are taking not a lot of market risk right now. We're fairly neutral. That's a little dissimilar than the peer group, where they're taking a bit more equity beta risk. We're about 0.1 on a beta calibration. If you know what that means, we're only about 10% of the risk in the equity market. So we're taking a very low level of risk. Again, in a period where equity markets are doing substantially well, we didn't participate in that rally. And so the contribution from the equity-related hedge fund strategy has been pretty muted. So long story short, it's been one of the toughest parts of the portfolio. I'm not real happy with this outcome. I had a conversation with our portfolio management team early this week about this and said, are you guys still convinced that this is a portfolio for NG? Is it working as you hope it would? And what is your outlook? And they told me, they said, yeah, no, we kind of grind our teeth. The outcomes have not been what we've expected, but they're still very convinced. Some of the underlying managers in here that have had these negative outcomes are still very well positioned to do well going forward. So, you know, I have to believe that that is accurate and that is correct. But because we're looking over a relatively short window of time, particularly against this absolute return benchmark, you know, it's not looking very good. And that is really the major driver, frankly, in why our portfolio has lagged versus its benchmark over the last 12 months. Let me stop there for a second and see what questions you have.
I do have questions. I mean, I think that's sort of an understatement. It's lagged 12% over the last 12 months. And if you take a look over since inception, over the last 24 months, we've lagged close to 5%
per year.
Yes. Per year. Is this where we want to be? Are we making the right decisions here? I realize 1 and 2 years isn't enough data, or it's not a ton of data. It might be enough data. Only you can answer that for us.
Sure. No, like I said, I'm disappointed in this outcome, to be real honest. The fair comparison of, you know, if I were to go out and buy a basket of hedge funds and not know anything about them, how would I have done? They were down about 4% over the last 12 months. So we lagged that group, but not by 12%. We lagged it by 2%. That's cold comfort, but I wouldn't say we're wildly out of line of what the hedge fund industry, in some respects, have generated.
Yeah, if you set a really low bar,
and we're not very high above, we're not very far off of the really low bar. I guess in that perspective, that's wonderful. But that's sort of tough for us to go back to the public and explain.
For example, you could have invested more in fixed income and real assets, and the results would have been better, right?
Agreed. Yeah. And that is something I'm actively looking at right now, is that I think I'm going to come back to the committee on the next meeting, potentially make some recommendations here. Like I said, our hedge fund portfolio management team does believe that these are good underlying managers, but given the results we've seen achieved here, it's been tough. You know, Wendy made a statement early on in the conversation that, you know, it's difficult to make a change just after you have a run of bad performance, because all you're doing is you're locking in that performance. Right. And if you have confidence that it's going to come around your way, that may not be the right choice. So I'm going to be sitting down with my team internally, and we're going to talk about, are we deploying NSHE's assets in the right capacity here, and what changes we might suggest to fix that up. And part of it may be deploying more capital towards the fixed income and real assets on a go-forward basis. But let me come back to you folks on the next meeting about that.
I feel, at the risk of oversimplifying this, basically stocks and related investments like real estate, you guys correct me if I'm wrong here, stocks and related investments like real estate, corporate bonds, give you the highest return over time. If you just said, forget about risk, I want the highest returns over time, you put all your money in stocks, you put all your money in real estate, and you'd look for those equity-related investments. The reason that we don't do that is because sometimes the stock market goes down and then everybody freaks out. So what Russell does, for example, is they invest in these diversifiers, real assets, and fixed income that offer the prospect of returns, but not from investing in the stock market, from other things. They won't offer as big a return as the stock market, but they'll also not give you the same sort of risk. And so that's why you diversify. So he has the choice. What he's saying is they've got investment in diversifiers, but they could equally just separate that money and put it, more of it in real assets and fixed income, and use those as the vehicles to diversify the portfolio. So that's the sort of plain English explanation of what he's trying to accomplish, I think.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say it too complexly there.
Yeah. Just assume that at least the chair doesn't understand this stuff, so make sure you explain it in such a way that he does. My question is, if 2 years isn't enough time for you to look back and analyze the performance and whether or not we should be in these diversifiers, how much time do you need and want?
That's an excellent question. You know, our expectations for this asset class are based over, and I showed this to NSHE early on when we did our strategic review work and said, what are the asset classes we want to have in the portfolio? Hedge funds, we believe, are going to generate something north of 6% absolute over the next 10 years. So this outcome is way outside of that expectation. Make no bones about it. But, you know, I recognize that, you know, over a two-year window, it starts to feel pretty uncomfortable. I'm unhappy about it, because if this wasn't part of the portfolio, my relative results and absolute results for you would be notably better. So I hope you take it that I understand that I'm taking this pretty seriously. This is not a great outcome for you folks, and I'm not happy about it. But I have to also kind of defend the fact that hedge funds are a very valuable part of a portfolio. They're not. These are used very, very heavily across much of the nonprofit space. They have played their role historically, but over this window of time, it has not been the case. So we could easily see the rebound in this part of the portfolio happen over the next 6 to 9 months, but it also might take two more years. And I'm not trying to be cute here or kind of speak out of both sides of my mouth, but honestly, it really is going to come down to how the market environment kind of rewards these particular underlying strategies. As Russell said, some of these are really not baited or not rooted in the actual security, whether it's an equity or bond. It comes down to sometimes about the trading strategy employed by the manager and where they're overweight and underweight. And that's primarily what's gone on here, is that the underlying sub-advisors have made some choices to be overweight segments of the marketplace on a tactical basis that have not been rewarded, but they're sticking with those bets with the intention of those coming good.
Okay, let me ask the question again. How much time do you need?
Are you're asking how long before I think this portfolio
you
is going to rebound?
You told
or how
us
long?
That 2 years isn't enough. How many how many months is enough for you to make a recommendation to us whether or not we should remain in this space or reallocate it to other spaces?
Well, I'll make that recommendation to you on the next meeting.
It's their choice, really. We've okay. delegated that responsibility to them. It's up to them to make the right choice, okay. and then we judge.
Well, actually, Russell, right? I think it's important that we make a distinction here. Russell does okay. not have discretion over your asset allocation outside of the assets within each of these vehicles. I have to come to you with a formal recommendation about how you deploy your capital between hedge funds, real estate, equities, bonds. That's not discretion that we've been given with the contract we have with NSHE.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's say that we change the instruction to you. Should we be in this space?
Yeah.
At face value, you have to say it hasn't been the right place, and maybe it's time to step away. But I really need to have a hard conversation with my portfolio management team in-house about do we kind of abandon a part of the portfolio we think has good long-term prospects given short-term results? Is there something, categorically wrong with this part of the investment market? And I don't think we will say yes, but I do need to have that conversation internally, and I will come back with a recommendation at the next quarterly meeting.
The next meeting will be in September. Wendy.
I just wanted to point out a difference in benchmarking approach, and I want to echo Matt to say that this sort of absolute return benchmark is – Cambridge would philosophically not use an absolute return benchmark like this because we think it's an unreasonable benchmark for shorter time periods. So I want to completely echo Matt's commentary, and this sort of ties into the page 15 of 40 in the Cambridge section that I pointed out, which is – different relevance of different types of benchmarks over different time periods. So this is why Cambridge, for our hedge fund portfolio, we're still using a market-based benchmark to measure shorter-term results. And we only look at long-term objectives at the total portfolio level. And we said explicitly in the investment policy statement, this is like a 10-year horizon for anything that's an absolute percent, you know, absolute percentage return. And the reason for that is you can experience significant market decline. So if you're experiencing a significant market decline, and these investments are in the markets, the likelihood that you're then going to be able to reach a cash plus 4% positive hurdle is almost not, almost zero. So I just wanted to sort of lend my voice of support to what Matt is saying about, in some ways, this may be setting appropriate expectations through the benchmarks.
But who sets the benchmarks?
So both Cambridge and Russell proposed benchmarks, and the benchmark that Cambridge proposed for our hedge fund portfolio, Matt had referenced the beta of his hedge fund portfolio is 0.1. We're running a hedge fund portfolio with a beta of about 0.3 to global equities. So we proposed a benchmark of 0.3 of global beta adjusted global equities, right? So our benchmark is more capturing the market movements, which we think are outside our control, and more reflecting the manager's outperformance relative to that market benchmark. And we would still hold ourselves to a similar long-term return, as Matt said, of this 4% absolute return. So in some ways it's a benchmarking difficulty, I think.
We didn't set the benchmark.
No.
Correct.
Okay, you set the benchmark, and so we expect you to set the benchmark realistically.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to accept that 2 years is not enough time.
Yeah.
Unless you tell me how much time. And if you're telling us that 10 years is the amount of time we should use as our look back to realistically analyze this, then we'll go ahead as a committee and analyze that after we meet with staff. But we didn't set this.
Correct. Right. No, I agree.
Okay. Thank you very much. Matt. Matt.
Okay. I have a question.
So, that was a
excuse me. Regent Trenchard, there's a question down here from Regent Carter.
Regent Carter.
Sure, I just want to make sure I understand. I'm looking at slide 24 under growth net for 1 year, and that's 0.31%. Is that the actual increase over last year? 0.31%?
That's correct.
Okay. So if we would have just put this in an S&P 500 fund, that returned what last year?
Good question. I'm going to take that up. I should have it here real quick. No. I don't think it's that high. On a one-year basis, 4.5% for the S&P.
Okay. And then, okay. So I guess my question is to Mr. Campbell, like, is there... I mean, do you see a reason why we're paying higher fees for this return rate when we could have just had the S&P 500 at a lower cost to us?
This was the question that I posed to Wendy, and I think it's appropriate to pose the same question to Matt. What's the rationale for, you know, given that just simply investing in the stock market index fund or in a bond market index fund, you would have done better, what's the rationale for continuing to pursue active management? And I guess I'll leave it to Matt to answer that question.
I think it's a fair question. You got to recognize that, you know, you can find a benchmark that is going to be always better than you if you look past, you know, look backwards. The S&P, if I had known with perfect foresight that the U.S. equity market was going to do what it did relative to the rest of the world, that's where I would have put all your money. Unfortunately, I don't have that crystal ball. So we got to build a diversified portfolio. Our long-term track record of the growth portfolio is pretty good. We've outperformed our benchmark by about 1% long-term since it started. That portfolio was meant to mimic a global equity portfolio, not the S&P 500. So probably the fairer benchmark to compare you to, if you were to say, what's the last 12 months been for the global equity market? It's up 40 basis points. So basically, we're in line with the global equity market. The S&P has been an extraordinary outperformer. So we've kind of held our own versus broad equities, if you include the rest of the world, emerging markets, Europe, Japan, and so forth. So I think that's an okay outcome. I think active management has had a stiff headwind in its face for the better part of 5 to 10 years now. A lot of that has to do with a huge charge into growth stocks, primarily the big cap tech names, and that's been very painful to most strategies. Russell is under the impression right now, Russell Investments, we're under the impression that value stocks are likely to be rewarded on a go-forward basis. Those stocks tend to be more, they're cheaper priced. We don't want to overpay for growth, and so buying cheaper stocks is kind of in our nature. Also, we think the market has not appreciated some of the fundamentals of these cheaper priced companies. And what I mean by that is that they have good earnings. You're not paying as much for those earnings. Why wouldn't you buy that? But everybody's been enamored of buying, say, Amazon or Netflix or Google. All good companies in their own right, but the multiples you have to pay for them are very, very high. We're of the opinion there's a lot of price risk in that. So we're betting in a part of the marketplace we think will be rewarded going forward. Recently, though, we've just kind of held our own, and we think that's been okay given what the market circumstances have been. So active is valuable. I think in adding additional return to your portfolios long term, it should help if the active manager does their job right to navigate some of the risks as well. Like I mentioned earlier, part of the outperformance we generated in fourth quarter was due to the fact that we took less risk because we felt like there was going to be a bit of a market fall, and that did occur, and so we were able to deliver some value there. The fact that we've held in there so far in 2019 after a big rally back in the equity markets is pretty comforting to me. It means that we've done our job. We've managed some risk at the beginning of the downturn, and then as markets started to heal a bit, we've been able to hold in there. But, you know, looking over the last 2 to 5, 6 months, that's a fairly short horizon. So long story short, active I think is valuable, and I think it's going to likely be more valuable going forward because the market is more than likely going to be more volatile in the next 5 years than it has been over the last 5 years.
Just to provide some historical context as well, one of the reasons that we hired Cambridge and Russell Investments was because of their investment process and historical track records. And I don't see any evidence that these two firms have lost their minds or their ability to invest in the last 3 years. So things go back and forth, but they are, you know, premier investment firms. And as long as we stay on top of them and ask good questions and, you know, ask for explanations, I think we'll be fine.
Any other questions before I have a last question for you, Matt? Region Hayes.
Yeah, I was just curious. You talked earlier in your presentation, and we've talked for the last several meetings about your defensive position toward the equities market, and that defensive position paid off in this last quarter or so. I'm wondering, is there any analysis you've done to show, had you not taken that defensive position prematurely, and I get we don't have a crystal ball, so we didn't know when to take it, but had you not taken it prematurely and had merely taken the losses that happened in this fourth quarter, would the gains that we lost out on in the previous three quarters have been more than the losses we would have gotten in the fourth? So did that premature defensive position actually pay off or not?
I think sum total it probably still behind, to be honest. I think fourth quarter we got some of that back, but we were early. That's on us, that we should have been more constructive. But, I mean, remember, we've had a pretty tumultuous kind of environment, politically speaking, and there's been some new things that have come out of the woodwork that kind of got us to a better place, economically speaking, than I think we would have guessed 12, 18 months ago. When the tax policy changes happened here in the States, people thought they would be accretive to kind of the economy, but it was like turbocharging the economy, in honesty. I mean, we had a GDP print last year, I think north of maybe around 4%. That's really, really good this late in an economic expansion. And so equity markets have really rallied, especially here in the States. So we had biased away from the United States because it's been so expensive. Our equity multiples were at like all-time highs. And if you think about, the game we're playing here is kind of a balance of odds. You make bets, you make decisions on areas of the marketplace that don't look to be richly priced or overpriced, and you typically allocate towards areas that are likely to be cheaper and hopefully going to be rewarded long term. So I guess the short answer is yes, we're early. In retrospect, it would have been better had we not. I think we're still behind on that bet. But we're not done with it yet. I think we're still positioned in a way that our view on the United States, if it actually starts to slow more and it has a tougher equity run than the rest of the world, I think we're going to be well served by that. And also this value bet we've had in the portfolio for a long time, that hasn't got paid at all, and I'm pretty sure it's going to, and it's going to be a nice reward for us.
Any other questions?
I just have a comment.
Okay, Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you, Regent Trachuk. Just Matt, I just want to say that when you go back to your managers, I know Wendy mentioned it in her presentation that the managers sometimes pick who they have, and some of them really like having nonprofits, and that just we're not trying to make money for people to get rich here. We're trying to help students. And I see students as our stakeholder. And the better you can do for us, the better we can do for our students. So that's all I want you to take away from that.
Understood. And I'm fully on board with you folks. I was recently talking to another university system about managing assets just like we do for you. And that mission is top of mind for us. Obviously, we want to deliver you the best results we can. And I am sorry that we've not done as good a job as we'd like to over the last couple of years. Absolute returns are okay, but on a relative basis, we have some work to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and my final comment is in every single period, we're underperforming the benchmark. And so my question is the benchmark the proper benchmark, or are the investments the proper investments? We'll ask our staff to continue to analyze that, and we look to both you and Cambridge to come back to us and tell us if our expectations are realistic. We'll move now to agenda item number 5, operating pool performance. Wendy, this is back to you, and I think for the two new members, it's important to keep in mind that Cambridge oversees this. It doesn't manage this. We're the managers sitting here in this room. And if that doesn't keep you up at night, you're not paying attention. Quickly, Wendy, and then I have a series of questions on this.
Certainly. So before I get to our action items, I would suggest starting with an overview. I think one of the key parts of the performance of the operating fund is the reserve account. And we have a nice graphical overview that's on page 49 of 57 here for the operating fund. And the good news is with this market rebound recently in 2019 to date, the operating fund is up 4.7% over those 2 months, which brings the fiscal year result to up 1.3%. Both of those are about 10 basis points behind the policy benchmark, so very close, but a very slight lag, mostly driven by the opportunistic allocation, which is meant to add diversification, but didn't. Tends to be more pro-cyclical, so in the fourth quarter sell-off really dragged on returns. But the good news is you see this green line, we're back up to a 4.2% positive balance in the operating fund after it touched close to zero in the fourth quarter. That's an operating reserve balance of $31.5 million. I would echo Matt's earlier commentary that, we like Russell Investments, do foresee an ongoing environment of market volatility. So I just want to point to the ups and downs of this line and want to make sure everybody is prepared for potential declines again if the markets do go down. And it would take, just a 4.2% decline of total assets to bring this operating reserve account back to zero. Then, as historical context for the newer members of this committee, you'll see back in 2008 and 2009, the reserve account balance went significantly negative, close to 20% negative. And during that period, it was almost a three-year period from September 2008 to August 2011, NC suspended distribution to the campuses from this pool to rebuild that reserve deficit.
And then we created a $50 million reserve fund that couldn't be touched in any of the distributions during that same period.
Correct, but that buffer is already included in this 4.2%. So this is just context for all of the positive returns that we're targeting in this pool. It really matters to the payout. Our biggest action item in the operating fund relates to our recommendation on page 19, which we're recommending simplifying the Global XUS manager structure by moving from two active managers into a Vanguard passive fund, as we are in the U.S. equity allocation. This is precipitated by a couple of factors. The move to semi-annual meetings, also there have been some agenda items and there's some work planned around reviewing the operating fund, different potential management models for that. And kind of the most time-sensitive precipitating factor is our recommendation that we believe that NC should terminate a manager that's been in place since 2011 called Manning and Napier. Our research team has lost conviction in this manager. They've had some rough performance. We don't ever want to exit a manager because of rough performance, but they've had some organizational changes, staff departures. We believe that there's increasing organizational instability, and we haven't been particularly happy with the answers that they've been giving us about underperformance. It's a low turnover strategy, and we never want to fire at the bottom, but in late 2018, their trailing three-year numbers came back up to what we would consider kind of middle of the pack among peers. And we think that by taking this partial recovery as a time to exit, we view that as prudent. So that's what's really driving this recommendation to change the manager structure within the operating fund. And again, we think that a passive approach is the best way to go in the operating fund.
And I'd like to hear both from Andrew and from Russell what you would suggest we do with regard to this recommendation.
I think you'd also mentioned a couple of active managers, too, or you'd put them forward.
We had put them forward because, well, as Regent Trachok mentioned, this committee is effectively has discretion over this portfolio. And historically, the committee has liked to see different options and evaluate different options between managers. Okay. The two options to replace Manning and Napier are managers that of which we think very, very highly. One of them is in the endowment portfolio. The other one is one that we've considered for the endowment portfolio. At the same time, given the move to a semi-annual meeting cycle, I think that makes this committee, as decision makers, less nimble to respond to market environments and consider action with active managers. And we also see that since we put these two active managers into place in 2011, one has worked out very well, the other one not so much. And these can be long cycles of underperformance. And even a manager that we have high conviction in, their style may experience longer periods of underperformance. So if there is a review pending for the operating fund from a top-down perspective, I wouldn't feel my best thinking would not be to recommend an active manager, right, because if you don't want to start a big relationship with an active manager and then terminate the relationship if a bigger review is underway.
I mean, just going back to Manning and Napier, I know them very well, and they heard the reasons that she's given are quite sensible, and it makes a lot of sense, and I agree with the idea of going to the passive vanguard. Now, you also mentioned Morgan Stanley. You'd sell them too? You're going to sell both global equity managers, right?
MFS. Yes, we recommend just simplifying the manager structure. MFS, we still recommend for client portfolios. Okay. We still have conviction in them.
But you'd sell them too.
We just would. I think it just makes sense moving to a semi-annual structure.
Right.
We won't have any surprises relative to the benchmark. Right. It will just be passive, low fee. And I think that makes sense for the current decision-making process that we have in place.
Andrew.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree. I think, and there's two things going on here that are happening. Obviously, the fund manager changes, and then also rebalancing and meeting our policy targets as well. And I agree with the pending review of the operating pool that it makes sense to go to the Vanguard index fund.
Okay, why don't we address these two action items, and we'll go back, because there's a few things I think we need to have staff go back and examine for us when we're dealing with this operating pool. So do I have a motion to approve the recommendation to change change out Manning and Napier and MFS and go to Vanguard Developed Markets Index Fund?
So moved.
I have a motion. Regent Carr, do I have a second? Regent Hayes, any discussion or questions? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. So let's take a step back, if we could, Wendy. And if
one more item, the rebalancing as well, the cash at 60-30. Do you want to deal with that as a motion as well? Yeah.
Okay.
So this is our rebalancing recommendation.
I have a question as well.
Yeah, but that was part of. Was the motion only for changing out and not the rebalancing?
Yes.
My apologies. We have a motion to rebalance, which would be moving $21 million in the existing fund down to the short term from the long term, and then the balance would be 60-30, which has been the target for this fund for quite some time.
I have a motion. So moved.
Regent DiCarlo, do I have a second? Regent Hayes, any discussion?
Sure.
Seeing none? Yes.
I just have a quick question for Mr. Campbell. So it looks like we're in the operating fund, we're pretty heavy in the stock market. Is that a normal position? I know we're just voting right now on rebalancing that, but would you kind of provide a little context to what you think why it should be 60-40 or 70-30, or what might be the best percentage to allocate for operating fund?
That comes down to our investment policy, and we should be reviewing our investment policy each year, and that's the direction that we've given to Wendy for the purpose of her recommendations to us. So what Wendy recommends in return is how to rebalance, how to make the moves necessary to get back to our investment policy. So yes, it is the policy that we've had for quite some time. But keep in mind, that's separate and apart from the short-term reserves that we have, the intermediate part for any upcoming expenses. This is solely within the context of the longer-term pool, and that's typically a more aggressive pool for any investor.
And
does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
The, and I'll come back to that, Regent Carter, because the, I think it's important for us as a committee to take a look at this entire pool here, what the requirements are and why we have it broken down the way we have it broken down until we understand what the cash operating requirements of each of the eight institutions and the system office are. Yeah. We can't really make a decision as to what the appropriate allocation for long-term, yeah, intermediate-term, and short-term. And I think we need to know that first, and then we can balance amongst those pools, if I can call them pools.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have a motion and a second. Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Passes unanimously. And I think it's important for us to keep in mind here that the overall return on this pool, which is a significant amount of money, is 5.26%. So this has outperformed any of our other two pools. So that means that this committee is just doing a bang-up job. We're outperforming our paid managers. The other thing that's important to keep in mind, at our last meeting, we made a policy decision that was approved by the board that the maximum distribution from this fund to the institutions is 2.75%. And we've been doing this on an ad hoc basis going forward. And my suggestion to staff, and I look for comments from my colleagues, but my suggestion to staff is to go back and work together with the eight institutions and do a cash flow analysis so we are comfortable that the amount of cash that are in these short-term investments, which can't be equities, it has to be liquid, that's the right amount that we'll need, each institution's going to need on a going forward basis. The same analysis needs to be done on the intermediate goals, because there are certain projects that each institution has targeted over the medium term, 3 to 5 years. We need to make sure that this pool, we have sufficient cash to meet those needs. And then the last question we would have is the whatever that percentage for the long term, do we want to continue managing the fund for or the pool for the long term? Or should we go with an OCIO? And I guess if we were taking fees as a committee,
it would still be a mistake.
It would
because you have legal liability. Yeah, you're taking fees, but you might not be able to afford
the court. We do not want to, in my opinion, we do not want to be managing the, we don't have the expertise to be managing. The only region who has the expertise can't sit on this committee.
Yeah, that's right.
Does anybody have any comments or questions on my recommendation to staff? Okay.
That's good.
Any questions on the charge?
No, sir.
Any other questions on the presentation on the operating pool?
I believe, Mr. Chair, that there was a pending motion.
We voted on it.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll move now to agenda item number six. And the just to make sure that everybody understands what we're doing on agenda item number six, the materials that were provided to us weren't crystal clear. You saw the strikeout for the first five pages, and then we went back to the red line, and there were only very few changes on the red line. The reason for the strikeout is because we're catching up, and if you see the top, that policy expired in July of 2017, and the and so we're doing a cleanup here, and that is no longer applicable. The same language, save and except for the few red line changes. There's a couple of strikeouts and a couple of additions that we have before this board today. So I just want to make sure everybody was clear on that. And I do have one change
because we didn't catch all of the language on the red line. I think consistently throughout, there are a couple other places we need to refer to the Vice Chancellor for Finance. That's, we now refer to it as the Chief Financial Officer. So I am looking for a motion to approve these changes. Regent DiCarlo, do I have a second? Looks like Regent Carter. Any discussions or questions?
Do you want me to just provide a little bit of context? Just because the purpose of the rebalancing recommendation and also delegating to staff, not only for rebalancing but also for the manager termination, is that now that we're going to two meetings a year from four, things can happen in the interim, and you want to give staff the ability to make changes. So, for example, if Bernie Madoff's managing our money and Cambridge comes to us and says, you got to get out of this right away, you don't want to be hanging around waiting for the next committee meeting. You want staff to just take that action and then come back and report to the committee. That would seem to make some sense. As well, the rebalancing recommendations, if the stock market drops suddenly or goes up rapidly and Cambridge says, you got to rebalance your portfolio, you're way out of whack here with your investment policy, it makes sense for staff to be able to take those actions and, again, report back to the committee on the actions, right?
And I have one suggested change to the motion, Regent Carter and Regent DiCarlo. This gives our CFO the ability to make those decisions for the rebalancing. My suggestion would be that it's a combination of the CFO and the chair of the board. That way there we have the, we're not, you know, in the future we won't always have Andrew. And so we might have somebody that's learning, and I want to make sure that we have this dual role where it's the chair and the CFO.
Chair of the board or chair of the committee?
Chair of the board.
Because the chair of the board is not allowed to participate in investment decisions, is my
understanding. He will be the chair of the board through June.
Okay. But in the future?
Then it'll go to the vice chair.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, it's on the rebalancing as well as the fund manager
changes. Yes.
Okay, so Chair Trachuk, if that's a friendly motion, I accept that.
Okay. Regent Carter, is that okay with you?
My question would be, I guess, why not the chair of the committee versus the chair of the board?
Let me put it to you this way. When I first took over as chair of the investment committee, I would not have been qualified to have made that call at that time. I was brand new as the chair. With the turnover we have on the board, I'm more comfortable with the chair, of the committee. I'm more comfortable. My recommendation is to go with the chair of the board under the assumption that the chair of the board will have sufficient history as a regent and overseeing the investment practices. And so, Regent Carter, I wouldn't have been comfortable making that decision myself if that would have come to me 2 years ago.
Okay. No, I accept that.
Okay. Any other questions? We have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, it passes unanimously. Agenda item number 7, divestment carbon neutral plan. This is for information only, but I would ask Russell to give us his perspective on this. And just to, for the two new members, this committee and the board has discussed and approved examination of what we as a system need to do to move to I think at the last meeting it was not divestiture, but it was carbon neutral investment strategy. And we're continuing on the path of these discussions. We've asked our two fund managers to tell us what does this mean. We have issues with our legacy portfolio that we can't easily change, and that's why we talked about carbon neutral as opposed to divestiture. But I think that Russell has some good ideas to throw out, and so if the five members of the committee could weigh in on that, that will give us some direction on how we should continue to proceed.
I should say that there's been a radical evolution in my thinking. I was a typical baby boomer CFA investor who hated this stuff because climate change and fossil fuel was all sort of airy-fairy. And the problem is, the concern was that it would erode returns. The primary purpose of the operating pool and the endowment pool is to accumulate wealth for beneficiaries to be able to pay scholarships and to make distributions in the future. My thinking has changed because climate change is not just a return thing, it's a risk factor. And so you cannot say that climate change, or most people can't say that climate change doesn't exist. I just saw a report today that in 2017, the effect of storms was something like $300 billion on the U.S. economy. There's a material potential impact on the value of our investments, on the value of this these portfolios that needs to be understood. So I think that by influencing how businesses operate, we can help them to mitigate change. So there's steps that we could take. Now, the ideal way to deal with a big problem like this is to have a big plan, to have a series of meetings with the investment committee, bringing in outside experts. And I don't know how many meetings you guys want to do on this topic. So, and
Regent,
there's no...
Regent Hayes said that he wants 2-day meetings to discuss this.
The other thing is there's no right answer. So even if you spent 10 2-day meetings, I don't think you'd come to any better solution. I think it's an evolution that's occurring not just in my thinking but in the investment world at large. And I think people are sort of feeling their way along trying to figure out what's the best way for one little investor like us to influence this big picture item. So my suggestion is to set up a series of pilot projects, call them. And maybe an example would be we have an index fund in the operating pool, and I think this was Wendy's suggestion. All these suggestions, by the way, would be done in concert with Wendy and potentially Matt as well weighing in. But doing something like buying the fossil-free index fund as an alternative to the just straightforward index fund that we have in the operating pool. But we could come up a list with staff and with our investment advisors of maybe 10 different things that we could choose from, come back to the next meeting and say to the committee, here's a menu of options that we could take. Let's take one or two or three of these and try. And then once we're on the path to mitigating the risk of climate change on the portfolio, and then over time develop a policy based on our experience, our impact, and it can encompass investing in things, divesting things, or maybe simply advocacy, voting, making sure we vote proxies, making sure that we participate with other investors so we have a larger impact on the world. So there's a variety of different paths that you could take, and it's up to the committee and the board, I guess, to figure out which path you want to take.
My only suggestion on that would be to let's don't do it like the menu at Adele's. Let's don't have 5,000 choices.
No.
Let's limit the
we'll
number
come up with
choices.
The pluses and minuses of each kind of thing, and try to focus it. Any thoughts on that idea?
I think that sounds like a sound approach. And I guess from a policy, I think one area where the stakeholder meetings can be really helpful, where I've seen other institutions that have decided to take climate action with their portfolio. Where it's been really helpful has been not to set investment strategy, but rather to build consensus around what are the objectives of the stakeholders in the organization. Mm-hmm. And that is something that, I know we've heard from students who feel very strongly on one side of that. I guess my one area of potential concern is that if we move along the path, if we jump ahead to investment implementation, and if there is not really solid understanding that the various stakeholders of NG and the campuses are all fully behind this,
right.
if let's say there's a dislocation in the Middle East and all of a sudden oil prices skyrocket and the NG portfolio suffers relative to what it would have been if it was just fully neutrally invested like the average investor, if NG hasn't gone through that process to build consensus and set objectives clearly, I would worry that then we would abandon a strategy after a short-term period of underperformance and then potentially lock in losses. Right. So I have my two clients that have really decided to take climate change. They did it over a very deliberate fashion, and it was because one of them was a liberal arts college with a massive environmental studies program that was like core to their identity as a campus. And by looking at the potential risks as well as their objectives, they feel confident that even if they underperform, they know that that was the right thing to do for them. The other one is a Jesuit institution, a Jesuit college that similarly, because of the Pope's writings on climate change, they know that because of their institutional values, that taking climate action is core to who they are. And even if there is some performance deterioration over some time period, they will stick with that strategy. So I guess I would encourage the committee to think about how there might be some sort of stakeholder assessment to really make sure that when we're starting off on an investment strategy, it has real solid buy-in from the institution and the stakeholders.
And all the stakeholders. I think that's a great suggestion. One thing I would ask Wendy, you and Matt, if he's down the line, and Russell and Andrew, first of all, if there's any literature that your clients have relied on, if you could forward that to the committee,
yes,
that will be helpful. The second thing is, and I a long time ago, I went to a conference with the investment advisors for various colleges and universities where this issue was discussed, and that was probably 8 years ago.
Right.
I think it would be helpful if we had a list of conferences that are specifically focused on this that one of us could go to,
yep,
sure,
so that we have a sense of what other people are concerned about.
And there are, in fact, there was one recently, a group called the Intentional Endowments Network, which focuses heavily on colleges and universities. One of my colleagues spoke there. We're very involved with this organization and published white papers with them. But there was, I noticed that there was someone from and this is an organization that looks not only at investment portfolios, but also what campuses are doing within in their operations. And they're trying to create linkages between operational efforts to combat climate change or deal with the effects of climate change. And there was a woman from, I want to say it was TMCC, who attended that. I saw her name on the list. So there may be stakeholders in the colleges that are already involved in initiatives like this.
Well, what I would ask staff to do is I would like staff to put together some form of a questionnaire to go out to all the stakeholders of all of the institutions to get some feedback on this so that when this committee, if and when this committee makes a recommendation to the board, we will have enough input, enough data that we are a recommendation will be defensible.
Yeah, and I might also suggest, you know, I think UNLV and UNR are the two largest participants in these pools,
yeah,
and I think it would be relevant to see what they're doing for their assets and their standalone foundations. The last time we checked, I think they were
nothing,
not taking any action on this,
yeah,
but so it might make sense to align and make sure that there's buy-in from the different institutions.
Then you're back to the 10 two-day meetings, you realize that? Because this is very complicated, and there's no one answer to this. My proposal was more, let's test this.
Before this test, we need more information.
Okay.
I personally need more information. I want to make sure that we at least know what some of the questions we need to be asking are before we even take that test program.
The idea would be that sometimes people can't understand something until they're actually exposed to it. You know, how do you – so the idea of having, say, the fossil-free index fund, just as an example, so you implement that and you say, hey, everybody, in the questionnaire, hey, everybody, we just put this in. What do you think of that? And so you can sort of test people's reactions as opposed to a hypothetical, we're thinking about fossil fuel-free – actually demonstrating that you've actually taken some action.
No, that's a great idea, and we're so glad that you're working free full-time for us. and we are going to get you actively involved with this process.
At Cambridge, we can also highlight, in some ways we do have pilot, okay. Since I'm very active in this space, and we as a firm want to be invested, we don't have any prohibitions, we don't have any mandate restrictions that says we can't go into traditional energy, but because we see a change, the secular tailwinds and a changing economy for energy, we are investing in clean tech initiatives on both the venture capital side. We have some credit infrastructure that's based on solar projects. So we could even just highlight some of these initiatives that are already in place. And we're not doing this because we have mission objectives for the portfolio. We're doing it because we think we want economic exposure across sources of energy.
I think Russell Investments has something similar, too. They have some investments. If Matt's still on the line, I think they have some initiatives along the same lines. Right, Matt?
Yeah, I'm still on. Apologies, I'm going through a bus terminal, right?
Okay.
But, we in our kind of decarbonization approach, we emphasize green energy. And like Wendy says, it's not because we want to, plant a bunch of trees and make the air clean. That's obviously part of the goal, but it's also make sure the economic outcome is kind of in keeping with what you need it to be.
Exactly.
So it's kind of a two-for-one, so I agree.
And is that in the NG portfolio now, or that's just an implementation option?
Option.
That's an implementation option that we can turn on. We're actually launching a commingled vehicle probably mid-late this year that'll have all of that architecture inside of it. So I can present that to the committee later if so desired.
Please. Good. And I love different lexicons from different experts. Dislocation means war, and 5 minutes if you're in the airline industry means 2 hours. any other questions or comments on agenda item number 7?
I just have one comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Treacher. I would just say that I would like to see a reasonable time frame for all this.
Okay. We'll move to agenda item number 8, new business. Is there any new business? Russell.
So I suggested two things. One is that since we've moved from 4 meetings a year to 2 meetings a year, it might be useful to recalibrate the sort of fixed agenda items. So, for example, spending rate was always discussed, I think, at the last meeting of the year. Investment policy statement review and expenses should be reviewed annually at one of the 2 meetings as sort of standing agenda items. So that's just a FYI. The other thing is, given the investment committee turnover that I've seen just in my time here, it might be useful to create a sort of an orientation package for people encompassing like recent meeting minutes over the last couple of years, investment policy statements, the latest Cambridge and Russell reports, along with maybe some highlights, summary of investment fiduciary standards. So everybody that comes onto this committee and is kind of thrown into the deep end right away has something to read before they walk into their first meeting and see all this, these 90-page reports come at them. And then finally, in theory, the investment committee is responsible for the UNLV and UNR foundations as well. At least the board is. And so at least, I don't know if you want to, I don't know what the politics are here, but at the very minimum, they should be received, I think, the foundation reports annually, because they end up in the board's financials. So they should be received by the investment committee en route to the board and approved, accepted, tabled, whatever the expression is, I think.
And that's a good idea. In fact, Joe, if you could check and see when those reports would be realistically would be completed. We get them in December, but I know they're completed before that. Maybe what we can do is we can schedule our second biannual meeting of this committee at that time so they can make the presentation to the committee. Those two foundation chairs can make those presentations to the committee so we can discuss it and then make our recommendation back to the full board in December at their December meeting.
Now, both those foundations have trustees, so they may be a little peeved, just speaking as an outsider. But, formally, they are part of the board's...
We approve their appointment.
There you go.
Right.
I'll check in.
Okay. Perfect.
And if I can also mention, over the past, I want to say 5 years, since there was a practice under... And this happened towards the end of last year, there is comparative performance between the system and the two.
Right.
Yeah. Just
Perfect.
Okay. Regent DiCarlo.
And can we get the hard copies again? They used to be mailed to us before the meeting.
Why did that stop?
We're going green.
We were asked not to.
We're moving rapidly.
You were asked not to. That's so helpful, having those.
You know what, if you want them,
we're certainly open to it.
Okay.
For those environmental sinners, we will provide a hard copy.
Let's make it on a request only basis. I don't need a hard copy.
Ready for the snow to end.
I'm sorry.
I can't do all this in my head.
I said, can we make that on a request only basis? I don't need a hard copy.
Yeah.
Folks down here that aren't interested in one.
Okay. Regent DiCarlo is looking for accelerated global warming so it doesn't snow as much as Lake Tahoe.
We got more this morning.
Move now to public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko?
No public comments in Elko.
Any public comment in Las Vegas?
No.
Is there any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, this is adjourned. I want to thank everybody, staff and Russell particularly, for all the hard work putting all this together. Great. Meeting adjourned.